This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States, has a lot going on. Last year, he helped launch the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. It aims to fight gerrymandering by changing the way legislative districts are drawn. The campaign is taking him around the country. He was in New Hampshire last week. That visit fueled more speculation about Mr. Holder's own possible political ambitions. The midterm elections are just around the corner. The Justice Department remains in chaos. And there is no shortage of issues that a former AG might help us make sense of. We'll bring you our conversation with Eric Holder in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Eric Holder, welcome to 1A.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, I should probably ask you about yesterday's primaries, California, New Jersey, lots of big races. I wonder what your takeaways were from that, particularly with regards to Democrats' chances in November.
Looked like there was a good turnout of Democrats around the country. It seems that Democrats are still energized. Makes me optimistic about what's going to happen in November. But I think that people need to understand that there's going to be a blue wave. But given the gerrymandered districts into which this blue wave is going, there's going to be need a lot of work that has to be done between now and November for a successful Democratic outcome.
I do want to talk to you about redistricting as we continue. But regarding the primaries, I wonder whether you take anything from the nature of this wave, whether it is going to be deep blue, whether it's going to be a little more bluish purple. I think we've already seen some candidates like Doug Jones in Alabama and like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district who've won races by appealing to people kind of on the left side of the right and the left side of the center. Where do you see the path to victory? Is it deep blue or is it a little more bluish purple?
You know, I think the Democratic Party is big enough to accommodate a Connor Lamb and the more progressive folks who are in the party. The reality is that the differences between the progressive wing and the so-called moderate wing of the Democratic Party, the differences are very small compared to the differences between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And I'm not particularly concerned about ideological differences within the Democratic Party.
Before we talk about more political races and redistricting, this has been a really busy and fraught time for the agency that you used to lead, President
to
Trump.
To say the least.
To say the very least, the president has had no reticence to tweet his dislike for Attorney General Jeff Sessions or the actions of the U.S. Department of Justice. There have been a lot of very kind of basic but foundational constitutional questions. Is it the job of the DOJ to protect the president? Does the president have the power to pardon himself? What do you make of this moment in which we are kind of teaching ourselves the Constitution in motion as it relates to our sitting head of state?
Well, I have to say that I'm extremely disturbed by the way in which the president has tried to interact with the Justice Department, and we've seen the impact of it. Morale, by all indications, is pretty low at the department. I read an article today that three people turned down the opportunity to be the associate attorney general. That's the number three spot within DOJ. And President Trump is breaking down all the norms that exist between the Justice Department and the White House. The Justice Department has to be, given its law enforcement powers, an independent agency. And his lack of understanding of that, his desire to be able to control DOJ and control the Attorney General is really kind of unprecedented and I think has a negative impact on the functioning of the Justice Department. If you look at the number of spots within the department that are unfilled, assistant attorneys general who are not there, head of the DEA, head of the ATF, a whole variety of places that need to have people in confirmed positions and are simply not there now.
There's been a question as to whether or not it is the role of the Attorney General or the U.S. Department of Justice to, for lack of a better term, protect the president. How do you see it?
That is not the role of the Justice Department. If the president needs a lawyer, he goes out and hires a lawyer. The Attorney General of the United States is the lawyer for the people of the United States. She's not there to protect the president or to protect anyone. The responsibility of the Attorney General is to enforce the laws of the United States, irrespective of who the person is and against whom an investigation might be directed.
How much of a difference do you think it makes that there is so much public recrimination between the Attorney General and the president? The president has said a number of times some not very nice things about Jeff Sessions, recently joked about, you know, having thought twice about whether or not he would have appointed Jeff Sessions if he thought he would need to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Does it really make that much of a difference that the Attorney General and the president get along, or do they just have to get the job done?
Well, they have to get the job done, and I think in an optimal situation, they would get along. But to be in a situation where we are now, where the president is publicly critical of the attorney general, I think tends to undercut the authority that the attorney general has to have as he's interacting with other cabinet members, as he's interacting with foreign counterparts. They can look across the table and know that this attorney general doesn't have the support of his president, and that has to have a negative impact on his ability to get the job done. Though I have to say, you know, the job that Sessions has been doing is not necessarily the job that I would want an attorney general to do.
In what way?
Well, if you look at the ways in which he has rolled back the reforms that we put in place with regard to the criminal justice system, the way in which they're handling this whole immigrant problem along our borders and separating children from their families. There are a whole range of issues in which the Attorney General has demonstrated what he was in the Senate. He was an outlier, a person who was not really in the mainstream when it came to law enforcement.
That's got to be frustrating for you on some levels, just watching from the outside now.
Yeah, it's frustrating, and in some ways it's almost heartbreaking to see that when we were on the correct path, I think, with regard, for instance, to criminal justice reform, where we were doing things that kept the crime rate down, kept costs down, reduced the number of people who were in the federal prison system. And he has reversed those things with this 1980s mentality of what we have to do is lock up as many people as we can for as long as we can, irrespective of what their conduct was. That's, I think, a discredited philosophy that he has put back in place.
Before I get to an audience question, General Holder, there's also been this question about the president and pardons, whether the president has the right to pardon himself. I feel like part of the conversation is facing in the wrong direction. Presidents don't have rights. Citizens have rights. Presidents have powers, right, and they have to use them responsibly or they will lose them. What do you think about the power of the president to pardon?
Well, the notion that the president could pardon himself is almost laughable. If you look at, there's an Office of Legal Counsel opinion out of the Justice Department that says the president cannot pardon himself. The pardon power is an awesome one. It's basically something that is almost unchecked. But the notion that a president could put himself above the law by pardoning himself is inconsistent with what the framers intended. It is inconsistent with our notions of justice.
But if the president did try to pardon himself, is there really anything that the DOJ could do? I mean, they're a branch of the administration. Don't they just have to kind of go along with it? Is there anything they could do?
Well, I'm sure that if the president tried to pardon himself, there would be somebody would try to file a lawsuit of some kind to challenge the validity of that pardon. It might be the special counsel. It could be the Justice Department. I don't know exactly who would bring the lawsuit. And I suspect that as it wound its way through the courts and ultimately was decided, I guess, by the Supreme Court, that the president's attempt to pardon himself would be ruled unconstitutional.
So it might end up being a moment where the DOJ might have to deal with it. Maybe the Solicitor General would have to deal with it if it came to the Supreme Court. But It sounds like what people keep describing as a constitutional crisis. It would take us to a place we've never been.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, and I think that you have people at the Justice Department would then have to decide where they stand. Do you stand with this president or do you stand with the Constitution? And I would think that resignations would have to be tendered or challenges made to the attempt by the president to pardon himself.
Let's get to a few questions. Owen writes, did President Obama ever instruct you, directly or indirectly, to influence an investigation the Justice Department was undertaking? More importantly, what was his feedback to you regarding the Hillary Clinton investigation? Two questions there.
Yeah, President Obama never directed me to do anything with regard to any pending investigation, whether it was criminal in nature or on the civil side. He understood that the best Justice Departments are the ones that are independent from the White House. The Hillary Clinton investigation really kind of took off after I left the Justice Department, but I'm confident that in connection with that, the president did not instruct Attorney General Lynch to do anything one way or the other.
Before we pause, we got a lot of questions about the bank meltdown of 2008 and the DOJ's role there. Dan asks, why didn't bank executives who committed fraud in the 2000s, causing thousands of Americans to lose their homes and costing the taxpayers millions of dollars, go to jail? If I were to hold up a bank and steal $100, I would go to jail, but you can fraudulently take billions of dollars and just pay a fine?
Well, you say, let's kind of make sure that we understand the context here. Just pay a fine. We had record-setting settlements in connection with those cases, you know, billions and billions of dollars, most of which was returned to the people who suffered as a result of these bank policies. So there was that part. With regard to the question of bringing criminal cases, if we could have brought those cases, we would have brought them. We simply didn't have the capacity, looking at the facts and the evidence and facts in the law, to bring those matters.
More with Eric Holder in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. So there are a lot of stories in the news lately about the right to free speech. But most people are surprised to learn where that right exists and where it does not. We get into all of this with the former president of the ACLU. This week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking to former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, now the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. As I was telling you during the break, redistricting and gerrymandering is one of our audience's absolute favorite topics. So
That means I'm doing my job.
You know, it's one of those things that just fires people up for a lot of reasons.
Good.
I do want to talk to you about that. I had one last legal question I wanted to ask you regarding the current administration, and then we'll move on from that. And that's about the Mueller investigation more broadly. There's tons of speculation at this point about what would happen if President Trump were to fire the special counsel Robert Mueller. I wonder how you see that, whether you see that as even possible or viable. A number of the president's aides and advisors and lawyers have said that would be absolute political suicide. It would be a direct path to impeachment. How do you see it?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure exactly how Congress would react. I'm not sure if it's a direct line to impeachment. I think it certainly, it probably ought to be a direct line to impeachment. But I would hope that the American people would not stand idly by and let something like that happen. Bob Mueller has conducted an investigation in the way that I would expect him to. You've not seen leaks coming out of his office. He's a man of integrity. He's simply doing his job. And if the president were to fire him or to order his firing, I would hope that people in the Justice Department would refuse to do that. And if the president was somehow successful in removing Mueller from office, I would hope that there would be peaceful yet massive protests by the American people. That is something that simply would be unacceptable.
So take us to the end of the Obama administration. You're stepping down as Attorney General, handing off to a new administration. How do you get from being the Attorney General of the United States to being involved in redistricting? Was it something you knew you wanted to be part of? Was there a period where you were like, okay, well, that's done. What do I do now? What was that like for you?
Well, President Obama and I actually sat down, I guess, a few months before the end of the administration and talked about our post-government lives and what it is that we wanted to be involved with. And we identified the whole question of inappropriate redistricting that occurred in 2011, gerrymandering, and said that is something that it's a structural problem. It leads to unfairness. It leads to dysfunction in Washington, D.C. It leads to gridlock, both at the state and federal level, and said, that's something we ought to attack. And so we put together this effort, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, the NDRC, to try to deal with the problem of gerrymandering. But the question that we both wanted to put before the American people was, do you think the system is fair? And we wanted to focus on that whole notion of injecting fairness back into our electoral system. We didn't want to gerrymander on behalf of Democrats. We simply wanted to have a fair contest between Democrats, Republicans, progressives, and conservatives.
President Obama is known for being very even-tempered, very level-headed. I wonder what you read going through the president's head, going through his heart as his administration was ending, knowing that his legacy was about to be assailed by someone who had made sport of denigrating him. That had to have been excruciating for President Obama.
Well, you know, he truly is this guy with this Zen thing from Hawaii. I'm from New York, and so I have Caribbean blood. I tend to boil up where he tends to stay pretty calm. But it must have been a difficult thing to be succeeded by somebody who had questioned his legitimacy, questioned, you know, where he was born, questioned even his grades. I remember at one point, at Harvard Law School. But I think he conducted himself certainly in public in an appropriate way, and did all that he could to ensure a smooth transition. But I'm sure that he is troubled, as I am, to see the policies that he put in place kind of mindlessly being reversed. If you look at the attacks on the Affordable Care Act, for instance, pulling back on the Iran deal, the pulling us away from the climate accords, and for what good reason? I mean, these are things that were designed to protect the world that we're going to give to the next generation, were designed to make our system more fair, increase healthcare access for people in this country, and to just pull away from all of that stuff has to be very frustrating for him.
Let's talk about the NDRC. What is it doing to improve the way the districts are drawn? How does that work? Is it just taking the Republican playbook and doing the same thing in the other direction, or is there more to it?
No, we are filing lawsuits where we have to do that, where we find systems that are so entrenched that the only way to change them is through the courts. We are supporting candidates who will stand for fair line drawing that will happen in 2021. We supported Ralph Northam, for instance, who's now the governor of Virginia, and who said that he would not sign a redistricting bill unless it came from an independent commission, and actually vetoed a bill that was sent to him last week because it didn't come from an independent commission. We're also supporting reform efforts where states have the ability to put before the people the possibility of creating these independent commissions that take away from the politicians entirely the way in which the lines will be drawn in 2021. And then we're also working on generating grassroots support, working with Organizing for Action, which is the latest iteration of Obama for America, and other groups to try to just make sure that we raise the consciousness of people about the importance of redistricting. It's really heartening to hear what you said, that your listeners really wanted to talk about and hear about redistricting and gerrymandering.
What about more direct forms of political movement in the vein of what Republican lawmakers have done? We heard recently that Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota is not going to run for re-election, but instead is going to run for Attorney General of Minnesota. That may not directly be related to redistricting, but in terms of Democratic efforts to go for more of those statewide offices, like, say, Secretary of State, which in states runs elections, what's your view on that?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, and the NDRC effort really is, we've done a state-by-state analysis to determine what is it that we can do in each state to have the greatest impact. And it varies from state to state. In some states, as I said, the only way to be successful in our efforts is through the courts. But in other states, it's really a question of supporting candidates in critical positions. Governors always matter. State legislators always matter. But if you look at Ohio, for instance, the Secretary of State matters a great deal. The state auditor matters a great deal. In Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court plays an oversized role in the question of redistricting, is one of the reasons why I went there to campaign for a woman, Rebecca Dallet, who was elected to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the first Democrat to be elected in an open seat since 1995. And so we go state by state and identify what are the races that we need to support. We've identified 12 states that we have on our target list, 7 states on our watch list, because in those 19 states, we think we can have, again, the greatest national impact.
And is NDRC helping with fundraising, campaigning for those candidates, or are you taking more of an auxiliary approach to help with the districts those candidates will be serving in? Is this a fundraising arm as well?
It's all of the above. We will give direct monetary support to certain candidates. In the Virginia race, for instance, we looked at what Ralph Northam needed and decided that if we ran a strong digital campaign on his behalf, that would be something that would be extremely useful. Again, we look at each race, we look at each state, and make specific determinations about how we can be most helpful.
Let me get to some of your comments for Eric Holder about redistricting. Plenty of concern about whether or not this is actually an independent effort. Kenneth also echoed that. Kenneth wrote on our Facebook page, "Political parties should have little to no influence over redistricting. In every state, it ought to be conducted by independent commissions and according to fair and consistent criteria that are available for public scrutiny. No gerrymandering and let the partisan chips fall where they may."
You know, and I'd agree with them. I mean, I think that if we had, in a perfect world, and if I were drawing up the system, I would have independent commissions in all 50 states doing this, take the politicians just totally out of it, because we have a system now where politicians are picking their voters as opposed to citizens choosing their representatives. But I have to deal with the world as it is. And there are only about 17, 18 states where you have the capacity to put in place these independent commissions by placing that choice before the citizens in ballot measures. And we supported that effort in a variety of states. California does it, I think, correctly. Arizona does it correctly. And I think that would be the best way to go. But where that option is not open to us, what we're trying to do is, as I said, file lawsuits, support candidates who will stand for fair redistricting. And it might seem like this is simply Democrats against Republicans, but what I would say is that the Republican power that they now have was illegitimately obtained as a result of the way in which the lines were drawn in 2011. For instance, if you look at Wisconsin, and it's the case before the Supreme Court now, Republicans got less than 50% of the vote in Wisconsin and yet got 67% of the state legislative seats and 67% of the congressional delegation. To combat that, and with the inability to draw, to use independent commissions, we have to fight that inequity through the electoral process.
I'm glad you brought up the Wisconsin case. I was going to ask you about that. I wonder how we figure out what the standard is, whether it's one of these state commissions in Washington State or California or Arizona that you mentioned, and there are other states that do this as well. I mean, even with the oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court about Wisconsin's districts, where Republicans drew district maps in their favor, or the case out of the state of Maryland, where Democrats did something similar, the issue seems to be figuring out when you've got it right. It's kind of like that old joke about pornography. You know it when you see it. Like, how do you know? Is anyone getting closer to actually clearly defining a formula, a litmus test for when we've got the districts right?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think that's the thing that really bothers Justice Kennedy. He had said that, in previous cases that partisan gerrymandering can go too far. But the question was, how do you actually measure it? And there is this process now that comes out of the Wisconsin case called the efficiency gap, which is really kind of complicated, and that's one way in which it can be measured. But in the oral arguments for the Wisconsin case, Justice Breyer talked about a number of factors that can be taken into consideration by courts as they look at systems to determine whether or not partisan gerrymandering has gone too far. But I can tell you this, you know, if you look at what the Republicans did in 2011, Princeton did a study and said that the gerrymandering that they did in 2011 was the worst that had been seen for the last 50 years. So, you know, whatever by whatever measure it is that you want to use, I think everybody objectively can pretty much agree that the Republicans went too far in 2011. But that's not what Democrats, at least through the NDRC, want to do in 2021. This is not an attempt to gerrymander for Democrats. I would describe this as a partisan attempt at good government.
I wonder, though, how we actually get to an accurate reflection of the electorate. I mean, we've known for decades now that the plurality, sometimes the majority of the American electorate, is neither Democrat nor Republican. It's independents. It's about a quarter Democrat, a quarter Republican, and mostly independents. So if the system was really fair, it could reflect that. But then if you're independent, you don't have a party structure behind you to help you run, so your odds of winning are lower. It just feels like this Mobius strip of problems with partisan representation, especially for people who aren't partisan. Is this a problem that can actually be solved?
Yeah, I think it can be solved. If you look at what happened in Pennsylvania in a lawsuit where we were involved, and look at the congressional delegation, although Pennsylvania is about a 50-50 state, slightly more Democratic, I suppose, than Republican, the way in which they had constructed their congressional delegation, you had 13 Republican-leaning districts, 5 Democratic-leaning districts. And now, as a result of lawsuits that were brought, the Supreme Court saying that what the Republicans done was unconstitutional, looking at the Pennsylvania state constitution, we now have a system that everybody agrees is pretty much 9-9, 9 Republican-leaning districts, 9 Democratic-leaning districts. And if you have that, that means you're going to have competitive elections, which means that the voices of independents, as well as Republicans and Democrats, will be critical in deciding who goes to Washington, or on a state level, who will go to the state capitol.
Let me get to a few more of your questions before we are out of time. Morgan asks, have he or his committee looked into applying a computational algorithm for improving our country's districts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that should be a part of it. Applying neutral principles would make a great deal of sense. But you also have to remember that there is the Voting Rights Act, which has to be taken into consideration and talks about making sure that communities of interest, especially with regard to minority communities, have the ability to be represented in Congress in appropriate numbers. So there's a balancing that you have to do between applying neutral principles, making sure that the Voting Rights Act is respected. But all of this is doable. And I'm really kind of confident that we can pull this off, that by 2021, we can have successful lawsuits, we can have successful electoral efforts, and we can have a good census in 2020 and a fair redistricting process in 2021.
A few more quick things I'd like to ask you about before we have to cut you loose. I hate to go back to a previous topic, but we got a lot of responses to the question about the Justice Department and the big banks, particularly wondering why the executives were not prosecuted more heavily. Chip asks, what evidence were you lacking in order to prosecute them? And EL tweeted, Mr. Holder's suggestion that the large fines make it okay that bankers got away with fraud is unacceptable. Just more proof that there are different rules for the rich and the rest of us. Can you explain that a little further?
Yeah, that's not what I said at all. What I was trying to say is that if you look at what the Justice Department did, you have to take into consideration the fact that we got record amounts of money from the banks that was redistributed to the people who were harmed. If those cases could have been made, they would have been made. These are career-making cases. Does anyone actually think that Preet Bharara, other U.S. attorneys around the country, would not have brought those cases if, in fact, they could have been made? Assistant U.S. attorneys, people at Main Justice here in D.C. If those cases could have been brought, if those cases could have been made, they would have been indicted. We simply did not have the facts, the law on our side. As I left the department, I made suggestions about how the laws might be changed with regard to the relevant statutes so that if we face a similar situation in the future, we'd have a better opportunity to hold people criminally liable.
I saved this question for the end because it's the one that I have to ask. I'm asked to ask you.
I wonder what this question is going to be.
Exactly. And since we know what the question is, I'm just going to lay my cards on the table. I think the answer is no, because I don't think you would enjoy it. And I don't think you would win because you don't want it. I don't think it is the lane in which you choose to run. Am I wrong?
Yeah, we'll see. It's just for those who don't know what we're talking about. We're talking about whether or not I'm going to run for president in 2020. We'll see.
And I don't know if you feel like cleaning up what you would consider Donald Trump's mess.
Well, you know, the thing is, I spent most of my life, most of my professional life, in government. I believe that, you know, Bill Clinton said that the era of big government is over. Well, I think that the need for good government endures. And, you know, I'm not sure. We'll see. You know, if I make the determination to do it, it'll be because I think I can win and because I have in my gut the desire to take on the responsibilities of the job.
Come back and talk to us about it if you do. Eric Holder, thanks very much for talking to us.
All right, thanks for having me.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.